From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm producer Megan Mack.
And I'm host Devin Dawson.
We open our podcast with the unusual comments from Rochester's Mayor Lovely Warren. We call them unusual because until this week, local Democrats have tried to say that there is not a split in the party.
But there certainly is a deep divide, and Mayor Lovely Warren acknowledged it head on when I asked her about it. In this clip, you'll hear her explanation for why she feels divided from her own party and why Assemblyman David Gant is so hurt by recent events. In this clip, you'll hear me introducing a past comment from Assemblyman Gant when he called his own party racist. The split in the Democratic Party, uniting the Democrats, it's been a theme for a while. And on this program, it came up in a way that I did not expect when Assemblyman Gant was on the program talking about a number of issues. Right before the end of the program, it came up when I had asked him, I said, I'd like to see more of you. We've got a mayor who's always happy to come on the program, a county executive, and certainly would love to talk to you more. And if we can listen to what David Gant said, which I kind of caught me off guard right at the end of that program.
Because I've watched the history over the years. Remember, I've been a public official for 43 years.
David Gant.
And I've watched exactly what happened to my community over those years, including but not limited what happened to us as public officials. We would want my guy to walk away from the Democratic Party because of the same racist stuff.
You see racism in the Democratic Party locally?
Pardon?
You see racism in the Democratic Party locally?
Did I? Ask the Democratic Party, they'll tell you.
So that was what he said that caught me off guard, Mayor, and he mentioned maybe I'll walk away from the Democratic Party. I don't know if he's ever expressed anything like that to you. He hasn't walked away from the party that I know.
Well, I don't speak for David Gant.
I understand. So I understand, did that surprise you, listening to that?
I think that we have to be, clear on what we're talking about here. Back in 2005, this community had a very contested mayoral race where you had Wade Norwood, who ran for mayor, and you had Bob Duffy. And when Bob Duffy won, I think that, if I, can give a little bit of a talk about what I think that Assemblyman Gant is talking about, and you can ask him for yourself. After the race, Bob and David sat down. And, they talked and they said, listen, we're going to do whatever is best for our community and working together. And I think that even though they were on different sides, they worked together when Bob was mayor, lieutenant governor, to actually do what was best for the citizens of Rochester and came together. And they put the political differences aside and we all rallied behind. Many people may not remember this. In 2005, I ran for city council and I lost by 7 votes. And so and Bob and I were able to develop a great relationship from that. And we worked together and we still work together to this day, respect him as a leader as well. But anyways, I think that in 2005, David remembers sitting down with Bob, having that discussion and saying, look, we're going to do whatever we need to do on behalf of our community. And Wade, I believe, had another line and Wade stepped out of the race and it was over. All Democrats united around Bob Duffy, and he ultimately became mayor, and they worked together since then. What happened in 2014 when I was elected, or in that race, was that after I won the Democratic Party, my own party ran another campaign against me on another line. And so David remembers that 2005 race, and he assumed, and everybody says, you don't assume. You assume that, okay, well, the primary is where the battle is. And once you win the primary, everyone unites behind the party's candidate. And that didn't happen. And the same party that we were both a part of, they ran another campaign against me. And so that's what he's talking about. When you expect a party to unite at that point in time, it was and I respect Tom Richards as a leader and as a man, and I think that he was a good mayor. But that didn't happen. It was the Democrats that ran Tom on another line, Democrats that are still part of this party, and not to say that they shouldn't be part of the party, but those are the issues that you're dealing with. You can't just wash that under the rug. Now, I remember I got an email from, a Democrat, one that is one of the people that ran this primary against me way before the primary, where she said to me, if you decide to run, you will destroy this party, and no one and me and my team will not be a part of supporting you, even if you win. Well, that's not Democratic values. That's not the way that you do business and unite a party. Those same people are a part of this, a part of the party today. They have discussions now where you hear, and I'm pretty sure many people hear the rumblings of, oh, we're going to primary the mayor and things like that and all that type of stuff. But I do the work that I do in this community for the citizens of this community because I believe in the city of Rochester.
That's Mayor Lovely Warren. You can hear the full hour with her via podcast at wxxinews.org/connections.
This week, we shine the light on an idea that could threaten the future of journalism in this country. Donald Trump has said that if he's elected president, he will push to open up libel laws. Trump says he wants to make it easy for politicians to sue journalists, even if that puts newspapers out of business.
We welcomed guests from both the Democrat and Chronicle and City newspaper, and we talked to attorney Chris Thomas. You're about to hear him here. He says Trump's push to loosen libel laws is dangerous.
A lawsuit against a paper like yours is going to put you out of business. And what's that going to do? It's going to reduce the amount of speech that we have in this community. And from my perspective, that's only a bad thing. And that is what I think Mr. Trump is talking about here. This is not just a left-wing, you know, all left-wingers think that New York Times is a great thing, and all right-wingers think that New York Times versus Sullivan is a bad thing. Just the opposite. There are scathing critiques of Mr. Trump's statements in both The Federalist and also in the National Review.
Sure.
Hardly known.
Daily Caller. Well, absolutely.
Right.
Sure. Yeah. And imagine if, you know, a Democrat could go after Breitbart in the same way that Trump would want to go after the New York Times.
That's a great point. I think about, you know, the local impact that this kind of thing can have. Because I think sometimes it helps for us to think about what would happen locally. Well, I can tell you, if Trump were successful, it gets elected and was successful in reversing New York Times versus Sullivan, and I agree with Dick that it would be an uphill battle and it would take a long time. Evan, you'd likely be out of work pretty soon. Bob Lonsbury would be out of work pretty soon. Rachel Barnhart, Gary Craig, Sean Carroll, people who go out and dig are going to be out of work because of these lawsuits. And this is not conjecture. That was what was happening in 1960 and in 1964 in order to quash speech. Now, let me talk a quick second about what we started out here with, and that's the UK. I could imagine somebody like a Mr. Trump saying, oh, come on. I mean, the UK, they've, you know, they love tea, they eat crumpets, and they've got a different view of it, and we really ought to be with them because they're much better mannered. Well, as Jeremy was just saying a second ago, their system stinks. And there was a reason that our Supreme Court voted 9-0 to reject their approach. And the reason is that it serves to quash the vigor of speech. And Jeremy was talking a second ago, alluding to libel tourism. Libel tourism is where Americans or people from other countries, usually people from billionaires and oligarchs from Russia, people from China, and real criminals and brigands will go. Well, they'll go to Europe. They'll go to UK to sue out libel matters. Great example that I think probably all of the listeners are going to know about is that first class lowlife Lance Armstrong. Remember? For years and years and years, I'm not a doper. I've won all these clean. I'm the greatest guy in the world. And so where did he go when he wanted to shut down a journalist who had done a dig on his doping? He went to the UK. And guess what? He won. And guess what? About 2 years later, he's on in front of Oprah saying, oh, I really, it was really a lie. That's because the UK system does not provide protections for journalists to dig into the dirt. And it's a perfect example, I think, of why it is that this idea, whether it comes out of Trump's mouth or someone else's mouth, is bad news for America.
Now to an interesting historical question. If Susan B. Anthony were alive today, how would she feel about the issues of the day? And listeners immediately wanted to know if Susan B. Anthony opposed or supported abortion.
We sat down with Deborah Hughes, the director of the Susan B. Anthony Museum, and Kate Cerulli, the director of the Susan B. Anthony Center at the University of Rochester. They stress that when you see someone quoting Susan B. Anthony about abortion, you're likely to find some distortion.
What we know about Susan B. Anthony is she didn't ever take a public stand on the issue. She was silent on the issue. She was very loud on the issue of believing that children should have sex education, that women should be able to time the frequency and the space between their pregnancies. She supported birth control. She was very clear about that. We also know that Susan B. Anthony did believe that a woman should have financial freedom and freedom over her body. But the reason that we keep having this conversation is she never made a statement directly for the criminalization of abortion or related to that.
But I think organizations like, for example, Feminists for Life, who quote Susan B. Anthony often, and again, you guys are the authorities on the quotation, certainly not me. I think what they may say is, you know, you've said, well, we can look to her quotes, her own words, her letters, to help inform what she might say today. And they're just trying to do the same thing. Here's an example. They use the following quotation on some various mailers and websites. Feminists for Life use this quote, quote, "Sweeter even than to have had the joy of caring for children of my own has it been to me to help bring about a better state of things for mothers generally so their unborn little ones could not be willed away from them," end quote.
Yes. So here's the shocking truth behind that. We, in today's framework, think, oh, that's talking about a child who's been conceived, a fetus, who has not yet been born. But the truth of the matter is it actually goes way beyond that. In Susan B. Anthony's time in the 19th century, if you were the man, you owned the children your spouse had, those who were conceived, born, and those who had not yet been conceived. A man could will away the unborn children that had not even been conceived yet. And that's what Susan B. Anthony's making reference to, definitely. In that statement. That was very common practice. It was one of the reasons she used it in her speeches in relation to temperance for years, that it was so appalling that a woman even couldn't control the children that were not yet conceived.
Are there misquotes that are occasionally used in the conversation about abortion?
Yes.
Yes?
The biggest one, there's a great bumper sticker. If only Susan B. Anthony had sound bites for some things that we could use, which is, "I abhor the crime of child murder." That's from an editorial that appears in the Revolution magazine. It's signed initial A. We have some very good evidence. In fact, we're going to be publishing an article in the next couple of weeks on our website that a local author's done a wonderful analysis that most of the editorials that were published in the paper that were signed by initials were particular people. Many of them were men. It was not Susan B. Anthony or Elizabeth Cady Stanton. But if you actually read the context of that, it says, "Though I abhor the crime of child murder," and it goes on to say, "We can't criminalize abortion," I'm paraphrasing that, "because," and it does say this, "it cuts off the head but ignores the noxious root." And basically that editorial says, before we even say that a woman can't have an abortion, we should be looking at all the reasons and all the social crises that cause her to think of doing that. And even at that time, one of the great crimes was that women were being forced to have abortions by their spouses.
I think based on the things that Deborah was speaking to, her belief that women had a choice for every aspect of their lives and should have the freedom to choose, I believe that she probably would be pro-choice.
You believe she would be pro-choice?
There's nothing I've seen in the works that I've looked at that doesn't. I defer to Deborah on the Revolution and to Carol on their read of those. I haven't read those newspapers, but the letters specifically have made no reference.
Her own letters.
Mm-hmm.
Let's close the week with a powerful story from a former foster child. All month long, WXXI News is bringing you the Fragile Lives series, examining the impact of children in the foster care system.
We met Damon Bradford. You're about to hear him tell his story. And as you listen, keep in mind that foster kids experience a higher rate of PTSD than American soldiers of war.
When I was maybe 5 or 6, I went into my first foster care due to my mom's illness. And I was in that foster care for maybe 2-3 weeks before I moved down south with a family member. And at that time, from then until third grade, I was in 10 different homes in 3 different states between family and foster homes. And when I was in third grade, I was placed in a foster home with my younger sister. And everything was going well for maybe about a year or so. And I got very sick. I had a sinus infection that spread to my brain. And I ended up needing a double brain operation. And I was in the hospital for maybe 2.5 weeks. And while I was in the hospital, the home I was in told the county that they weren't able to provide the care that I needed. So I was placed in another foster home with another foster family whom would come and see me while I was in the hospital just to get to know me. And after I left the hospital, I stayed with them for about 2.5 years before I returned home. And while I was home, I was pretty much being the man of the house, making sure my mom was taking her medicine, my sister was going to school. And in seventh grade, I guess, lacked. And my mom ended up getting sick again and going into the hospital. And because of the relationship that I was able to make with my prior foster parents, I was able to call them and they came to my help. And I stayed with them for maybe 2-3 weeks until my mom got better. And when it was time for me to go home, I told my mom that she wasn't suitable to be my mother. And I wanted to live with my foster parents that I was with. And I stayed with them. And in 10-19-10, I was adopted out of foster care, my 11th grade year of school.
11th grade year. So I want to kind of go back to when you said you were 5 or 6 the first time, essentially leaving home and starting that period of your life of just sort of almost, sounded like almost constant moving. Do you remember at all as a child what you were thinking about the constant moves and the uncertainty?
As a child, I wasn't really sure what was going on. Mm-hmm. To me, what was important was my sister and I had somewhere to put our head. That's what went through my mind the most.
Even as a young child, you were thinking that, and you talk about almost becoming the man of the house before you were a full-grown man. You had to grow up pretty quickly.
Yes, sir.
It sounds like. Now, you worried about having a place to put your head. What about food and eating? I mean, did that come with any stress or struggle?
Well, when I was in care or with my family members, food wasn't so much of an issue. But when I was with my mom, there was times where we would run out of food because there wasn't enough. She was on public assistance, mm-hmm. and she wouldn't get enough food stamps or something. And I personally wouldn't eat as much to let them eat. And that's really the only issues that we had with food.
Okay. Well, you know, we're going to be talking as we go throughout the hour about the impacts on kids and trauma and definition of trauma. I wonder now, Damon, I mean, that's for someone like you, is that something you think about? I mean, the word trauma, do you think of yourself as having experienced that?
Well, I mean, when I explain my story to someone on the outside, to them, it may seem to be trauma, but to me, it's life. It's all I know.
That's it for this edition of Weekend Connections. You can listen to Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and Finger Lakes Public Radio, WEOS 89.5 FM.
And you can always find us on the WXXI mobile app. Enjoy the weekend, and we'll talk to you Monday.